Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available as a podcast, obviously. It's also available on iTunes. And like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, they are available on Spotify. Hope you're having a good, relaxing Thanksgiving weekend. Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're staying good to one another. Hope you're doing some original things with your leftovers. We'll see about that. Maybe on next week's show we'll talk about that. But I hope you got to watch some movies that were new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. We'll get to your list in a little bit, the grab a pencil portion of the show. But I want to start things off because now it's we're past Thanksgiving, and now for a lot of people, focus is now shifted to Christmas, and here is something for your Christmas gift list for your movie fan out there, especially if you're a fan of Steve McQueen. There's a new book out. It's published from Dalton Watson Fine Books, and it's called Steve McQueen in His Own Words, and this is a heavy book, hardcover, with a slew of photographs and quotes from the man himself, from Steve McQueen. And this was compilated, curated, and written by Marshall Terrell, who's written several books about McQueen over the years. And earlier this week, I got to talk to him about this particular book, as well as the history of Steve McQueen, and, of course, a little bit of Indiana connection with McQueen. So sit back, relax, write down the title, Steve McQueen in His Own Words, and be a good gift for someone you know that's a cinephile, or for yourself. So anyway, here's my chat with Marshall Terrell. So Marshall, what was your first experience with Steve McQueen cinematically?
Well, you'll love this story. Cinematically, I want to say this is 1968, and I think it was the summer, and we were visiting our relatives in Arkansas, of all places, Texarkana. That's where I was born. But my dad was in the military. Anyway, we came back, and my older cousins took me to a double billing of Bonnie and Clyde and Bullitt.
Wow.
And I know.
Man.
Can you imagine you were 5 years old and you were seeing Bonnie and Clyde for the first time, their bodies being shot up like that? And I turned to my cousin, who's a real sweetheart. I said, well, what's going on? She said, well, he's getting shot. Because I'd never seen bodies reacting that way before.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course Bullitt with the chase,
Yeah.
You felt it in your stomach going up and down, but there was just always some sort of emotional connection to McQueen. And I wasn't the only one, but I think people feel that way about movie stars. There's some sort of emotional connection that just goes beyond cinema, and for some reason Steve McQueen always evoked these feelings in me as a kid. And then as I got older and I studied them, those emotions went away, and then it kind of got into, okay, who was this person? Why did he make these choices as an actor? Mm-hmm. What were his influences? Those sorts of things.
Well, I would say, I'm going to guess you and I are of a similar age. Well, you're probably a little older than I, but the idea of, as soon as home video hit, you were able to hopefully do a deep dive into what other titles you could get your hands on.
That's correct. And again, that deep dive didn't really occur until I started doing the book, because I think he died in 80. The videos, a lot of McQueen's videos didn't come out until much later for some reason. Some of the earlier stuff did. I mean, Bullitt, of course. But I kind of remember Towering Inferno coming in late. some of the earlier movies that he did. There had to be demand for them. So the popular ones got released first. And then the less popular ones came out a little bit later because they had to meet that certain demand. But yes, when I was doing research for the book, that's when I really did a deep dive into his filmography.
Yep. Now, for those listening, this is not your first time writing about McQueen. In fact, I believe the first thing you had published was a McQueen biography?
Yes, that's correct. That was published in 1993, and this is my seventh book on Stephen.
Woof!
And I didn't plan on doing it that way, but what happened was is that, you know, and I know you were around for this, but, you know, Humphrey Bogart had his renaissance in the 70s.
Yep.
And I thought, you know, and it was kind of just like a one-and-done kind of thing. It was kind of a season. I thought the same thing was going to happen for Steve McQueen. You know, it was, you know, almost, it was like when the book got published, it was 13 years after his death. Things started kind of coming around again. People remembered who he was. He was getting popular again with a younger crowd because a new generation had kind of come in and taken from him, and you saw it on the screen. And this was around the time that The Bodyguard came out with Kevin Costner, who adopted McQueen's haircut, and it became the McQueen haircut became like the haircut, the new haircut of the fashion world. So all these things were, and the movie, the remake of The Getaway was coming out.
Yep.
So all these things kind of converged when that first book came out. And I really honestly thought that it was just going to be a season, just like Humphrey Bogart. But then, like, McQueen just got bigger and bigger. It was just this phenomenon that I couldn't explain. So I think the second book that I did was with Barbie McQueen. She was Steve's widow. And we did a documentary together, and then the producer approached me and said, "Hey, Barbie wants to do a book with you. She's got 500 photos of Steve McQueen that have never been seen before, and would you like to do that book?" I said, "You bet I would," because that was the last years of his life were kind of elusive because he just kind of took a break from the public eye,
mm-hmm.
And Barbie had never spoken about Steve before, so. We did that, and then after that, people started approaching me about doing Steve McQueen projects. And you know, if you're publishing, you don't turn away those opportunities. So, I did other books in between, of course, but then McQueen would always kind of come around. The way I equate it, and I'm not equating myself to Martin Scorsese, but it's like Martin Scorsese gets to do a gangster picture. He gets to do one gangster picture every 3 or 4 years, and then he gets to do his other in-between projects, but he's got to do that gangster picture to stay in business. That's kind of how it's been with Steve McQueen for me. You know, I get to do other book projects. I've done biographies of Johnny Cash and Pete Maravich, the basketball player, Elvis Presley. I've done 3 books on him, and I just finished a book on Billy Graham. So, you know, I like to focus on the icons, but it always seems Steve McQueen always seems to kind of come back.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Scorsese because you know you have the artist and the muse, and he's had a few from De Niro to DiCaprio, and it sounds like McQueen has kind of become a muse for you in this case.
You know what? I've never thought of that.
Or Ford and Wayne kind of those pairings.
Yeah, I've never really thought of it in those terms. I just always thought in terms of he's captivating, he's complex. He's so epic that there's, you know, like when I do books on him now, it's just like just little slices. I don't have to do the whole thing anymore because I've done that. But I never thought of him as a muse because, but that's a very, very astute observation.
Thank you. It's your pledge dollars at work. So, so with this, Steve McQueen, in his own words, so you mentioned earlier that there were a slew of photographs that have never been seen before. When did the gathering for this book begin?
I started this in 2013. And the reason why I know that is because I wrote a press release in 2014 announcing the book. And the reason why it started was because I noticed like once a year or twice a year there'd be a new McQueen book out, but it was really just kind of rehash mm-hmm. of the old information. It was just never anything new. And I always felt like if I'm going to do something on McQueen, it's got to be something new. Something that audiences have never read before. So I kept seeing these books come out, and I kept thinking to myself, you know, it's a shame Steve McQueen never really got a chance to tell his story. And he had an opportunity twice. He was going to do a photo book with his wife, Barbie, and it was going to be called The Long Haul. And turns out that, you know, obviously he had the cancer, And we actually did that same book, but it was just Barbie's voice. It was called Steve McQueen, The Last Mile. So, you know, Barbie told me these are the pictures that Steve held in his hands that we were going to do. And that blew me away. And then he was also going to do a book with a memoir, as told to, with Los Angeles Film Times critic Charles Champlin. And I met Champlin a couple of times. We talked about that. But those negotiations really didn't go anywhere either because his cancer had advanced so fast. So I kind of that's how I opened the book. You know, Steve McQueen never had an opportunity to tell his own story. And so what I thought was what I'll do is I'll arrange all the quotes that I have on Steve McQueen because I wasn't able to use them for the biographies because you pick the best quotes. Mm-hmm. Some just don't fit. I'll use all the quotes that I have accumulated or that I have, and I'll type them on a piece of paper, and then I'll block them off into his life, and then let's see what happens. So it turned out I was able to extract almost 500 quotes, and they covered every little aspect of his life. And so then I arranged it in chronological order where it's Steve McQueen telling you his own life in his own way without any interruption other than just a caption or two here or there just to let the readers know like what point in his life Steve McQueen was at.
Yeah, I have to admit, when I was approached about reading the book and had heard about the size of it, I was like, oh, my God. I felt like I was in college again. But folks, to go through it, it's a lot of pages, but it is actual quotes from McQueen and a slew of photos. As I mentioned, I was able to not breeze through it, but I was able to experience it in a good half a day. And so it's not as, even though it's a large book, it's not as dense as you, some might fear.
Right. And that was my hope, is that when you read this book, you didn't put it down. Half a day is a pretty good clip, but someone once told me recently that this is like the Instagram book of McQueen's life. And I hadn't thought of it in that way. He's like, you tapped into something because I was getting this extraordinary publicity on this book. And I was like, I've written books that are so much more detailed. And he said, no, people today, they don't want to read the whole story, but they can get the whole story in this book. That's great.
Now it sounds like you're on the front porch with me with the kids these days. So going back to the beginning, of course, if you don't know, there is an Indiana connection with McQueen. Could you please share it with the folks?
Sure. Well, Steve McQueen, believe it or not, his grandparents. Well, I should start at the beginning. His mother was a teenager who got pregnant, and so she lived with her parents. She came back and lived with her parents in Indianapolis, and then Steve was actually born in Beech Grove at that hospital there.
St. Francis,
and. I wasn't really able to really find that out until like the 2010 census. Every 10 years, they update their census. And lo and behold, his dad's name was on there and the name of the hospital. And I went to Beech Grove, by the way, I think in 2010 with Barbie McQueen, and the hospital was still open. And we did a signing right near the hospital. And but before the signing, we checked out the hospital and there's a great guy there by the name of Joe Studeville who worked for the hospital. And I asked if there's an archive division. He said, yes. I said, is there any old photographs? And he said, yes. And that's the first photograph that you'll see is St. Francis. And then the second photograph you'll see is the actual birth certificate, which was found by a librarian there by the name of Will Smither. So a lot of the McQueen biographies will say, oh, he was born in Beech Grove, Indiana, but it will never give any context. And so not only was I able to just kind of explore Beech Grove, I was able to go there, check it out, see what it was, see why it's this enclave of Indianapolis. I think it's its own municipality, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really, really interesting. And then, of course, I went to the house where his grandparents raised him for the first 4 years of his life.
And how long was McQueen's Indiana experience?
I believe it was about 4 years. He was born smack dab in the middle of the Great Depression in 1930. And then they move out of the house. And the reason why I know this is because, you know, we looked up telephone directories And they move out of the house in 1934. And I believe it's because his grandfather got ill. I think he got cancer. And then, of course, I think the after effects of the Great Depression. So they move to his grandmother's brother's house. His name is Claude. He's Steve's great uncle, Claude Thompson. So the Thompsons, who had this nice small little house, now move into a cook shack on this property of Claude Thompson. And it's very, very sad. But Steve was able to move into the house with Claude and develop a relationship with him, who was a prosperous hog farmer.
Okay. And of course, there were stories about him as a troubled delinquent, correct?
That's correct. What would happen is that his mother would, now that Steve was safe and secure, she'd drop them off with the grandparents, and then she'd go off on her merry little way. So it would either be Indianapolis or Los Angeles. And when she felt guilty, then she'd call him. And then Steve would come into a situation where she was with a new man, and it was either uncomfortable. And in one situation in Los Angeles, she had married a guy by the name of Barry, and he actually beat Steve. So Steve basically, from that point on, he lived on the streets, and he was doing things like breaking into shops and stealing hubcaps and playing pool, and definitely was a delinquent and getting into fights. And so what had happened was is that, you know, he appeared before a judge who said, "Next time, young man, I see you, you're going to be going away." And then what had happened was is that when Barry found out about that, him appearing before the judge, he came back. They had a really big fight. He tossed Steve down a flight of stairs. Steve says, "The next time you lay your hands on me, I'm going to kill you." And then Barry and the wife, Steve's mother, decide that they're going to put him away into reform school. And so he served a 18-month stint in Chino's, in the Boys Republic in Chino. But that's where he started to kind of clean up his act.
And he's always had a connection with that place after he became famous.
Yes, he had always thanked them for helping him to give his life some direction. There was a gentleman there, a principal there, that said, "Steve, you know, you're a bright young man, and if you cleaned up your act, you could actually do something with your life." And he had appreciated that. And he was also introduced to literature there and acting, not acting for the stage, but just the concept of it and writing. And so, you know, he left that place, and it gave him the fortitude to join the Marines, which was the next step, and he joined the Marines for 3 years, but he'd always credited the Boys Republic for really kind of setting him on the straight and narrow. And they have a car show every year called the Steve McQueen Car Show, which raises close to now like $500,000 a year for these students in the school. So his name kind of is the gift that still keeps on giving.
Now, if I remember right, McQueen said in later interviews that the next phase of joining the Marines was a way of molding his tough guy image. Can you give an example?
Well, I'm trying to think what he meant by that, because he had always tried to mold his tough guy image. The quote that I have in the book is that he was desperate.
Okay.
He was wondering what he was going to do. He was in New York City when he decided that he was going to join the Marines, and basically said, "I didn't want to be 50 years old standing on the street corner and sparing for change." And so that's why he joined the Marines. But he also said that, "I joined the Marines because they were the toughest of the tough."
Got it.
And so I think that he knew that his life needed discipline. And, you know, for the next 3 years, he certainly got that discipline, because he went AWOL a few times, got tossed in the brig. But for the most part, he was a very good soldier.
Okay. And then after the Marines, he moved to New York City. And I know he started to get, before his film debut, got some unconventional, quote-unquote, acting modeling jobs.
you're referring to the pictures that I have in the book of him modeling for, like, these true crime pulp magazines that they used to have.
Mm-hmm.
And they look really extremely cheesy, you know, the kind of like, "I murdered my wife," or "I murdered my wife's husband," for $50, that sort of.
Yep.
And I did a book actually with Ed Kuki Burns of 77
oh, wow.
Sunset Strip. And he told me the same thing. That's what that's what struggling actors would do for a hardcore cash.
Mm-hmm.
And I think McQueen's wife, Neil, had said that she even had done that, some of that in her acting days. So, but the unique thing is that we were able to come across those photos. It's quite amazing.
And he also did some educational films?
Yeah, he did industrial films. His mother was going out with a guy who did industrial films, and Steve's first film, I think, was for Bell Telephone, and I think it was, and I've actually seen the film. It's like 25 minutes long. He plays a sailor, and he's really terrible because they show him on a phone, and he's charismatic, but mm-hmm. he's terrible. And so he did that. He also did a film, I think, that his mother's boyfriend got him, called Girl on the Run. It was 1953. It was a carnival film, and he's an extra, and he's in two scenes, and there's a photo of him in that as well. So. Uncovering some lost McQueen history there, because he did a lot of things that he didn't put on his resume once he became famous.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were just two of the things that we found.
And early on, there became a camaraderie / rivalry with another up-and-coming actor named Paul Newman.
That's correct. But before that, mm-hmm. McQueen always had to use somebody as a measuring stick to get where he wanted to go. And the first person was actually James Dean, and the two actually met. McQueen was a garage mechanic, and James Dean had come in with his motorcycle and did not know who McQueen was. And I know this story because Martin Landau told me this story. Landau was on the back of that bike with James Dean, and he knew McQueen, but Dean did not know who McQueen was, but McQueen certainly knew who Dean was. So they actually met just one time. But James Dean was almost the same age. Actually, yeah, they were both born in 1930. They were both from Indiana. And so McQueen always felt that he had been cheated and that Dean had gotten those acting jobs that he wanted. And so when Dean died, then that focus really turned to Paul Newman. And Newman got that treatment from McQueen, and so McQueen's first actual paying, you know, big league film was Somebody Up There Likes Me in 1956, and Paul Newman was the star, and McQueen was a $19 a day extra. There's a great picture of the two of them,
yep,
on a rooftop, fooling around, having a good time. So it looked like they were buddies, but make no mistake, McQueen wanted his status.
And we'll get to that. We'll reach that point in the 70s in a little bit. What led to him getting wanted dead or alive?
Well, he was mainly an unemployed actor in New York City, and his wife Neil was a very, very famous dancer in New York City. And she was also getting her turn in Hollywood, so she was making a film for MGM, and McQueen was really jealous. He went to a commissary one day, and he said, guys were elbowing me out of the way and calling me Mr. Adams. And he said, that's when I knew I had to become famous. And so he was driving her essentially crazy. So she called her manager, Hilly Elkins, and said, please get him a job. So he got him a job on a show called Trackdown, in a pilot show, I believe. And it was with Robert Culp. And McQueen, for whatever reason, stole the movie. I'm sorry, stole the show. It was a one-hour pilot show. And the executives at CBS said, who is that guy? Well, we want to get him a series. So that was the series Wanted Dead or Alive that led to that. So even though he was unemployed, he was getting better in his acting. He was able somehow or another to hold your attention on screen. And people tapped into that. So that's how he got that job.
And I'm trying to remember. I don't have the timeline in front of me, but I know two other films of note before as he was starting to get more notice in the business. One was The Blob, and the other was getting noticed in Never So Few.
Correct. Yeah, The Blob was before he came to Hollywood.
Okay.
And I think that thing, that was filmed in 57, And the release date was the same week that One of Dead or Alive debuted. So he had the 1-2 punch of that movie and the series. But he was very embarrassed by the movie because he thought it was just a cheap drive-in flick. He was going to get his money, and that thing was just going to disappear, never knowing in a million years that VHS would come along, DVD, revivals, the drive-in movie theater. That movie just kept staying alive and going through generations of fans. And so anyway.
And the Criterion treatment.
That's right, the Criterion treatment. That's the best of all. Later on in his life, he was a little bit more humble, and he recognized it for what it was. But there's a funny story about that I got to tell you.
Please.
So the producer of the movie, Jack Harris, told me this story. So the movie was made in 57, and let's fast forward to like 1971, 72. McQueen is now living in Malibu, and he's one of the biggest stars in the world. And so he's at a Malibu market, and he's getting his groceries, and the cashier is just fawning all over him. Mr. McQueen, you're so wonderful. Oh, I love you in this movie, this movie, this movie. And Jack Harris is like three people behind, and he's hearing all this. And he goes, oh, Mr. McQueen, what about the Blob? And McQueen turns to him, sees who it is, smiles, and he says, well, now, it wasn't exactly Othello, now was it?
Yep.
And that's how I got that quote in that book. Because some of these quotes are anecdotally.
Right.
They're captured through press releases, through old interviews, through raw Q&As, through a lot of different sources. But that one was passed to me anecdotally by Jack Harris.
and apparently he got along with Sinatra working on Never So Few?
Yes. He and Sinatra got along. And Sinatra was like a young kid. I should say he was a young kid. He was a young kid at heart.
Right.
So he tested everybody. He was a New Yorker. He was going to test and push everybody. And McQueen had the same feistiness that he did. And so on the set, Sinatra was lighting cherry bombs and throwing them off at people and seeing how they'd react. They'd jump in the air. And so one day McQueen had this machine prop gun and Sinatra was walking across the lot. And he didn't see McQueen. And then McQueen says, oh, Frank. And then he shot off this prop gun. And everybody jumps and scatters. Sinatra stood there, but he was scared. And then he and McQueen meet eyes, and then they both start laughing. And, like, from that point on, they just got on like gangbusters. They were brothers. And when the film came out, Sinatra gave, like, a homecoming concert, and there was a major film premiere in New York City, and he invited McQueen to go along. And McQueen saw the star treatment that Sinatra got. He had doors opening and limos and this incredible adulation, and McQueen turned to his wife. Neil says, and said, yeah, I want a slice of this. And so, but the wonderful thing about that story is on the set, Sinatra was the kind of guy that he got there at 9 o'clock in the morning and wanted to leave at 5, and he had a martini waiting for him and a beautiful woman holding that martini. And, he was off in a helicopter going off to Palm Springs.
Yep.
So he basically said to the director, John Sturgis, give the kid all the close-ups. And so he was very, very generous with his time, and that movie didn't make Steve McQueen a star, but it now put his name on the list of a lot of top producers in Hollywood and say, okay, this is an up-and-comer.
Well, and that would be his next film. And if I remember, did he do that while on break from Wanted Dead or Alive?
Yes, he did.
So Clint Eastwood had Rawhide and Going to Italy, and Steve had this. With the Magnificent Seven.
That's right. And by the way, McQueen and Eastwood had very, very similar careers, born the same year, and they liked each other quite a bit. As a matter of fact, you'll love this story. McQueen was offered Apocalypse Now, and he was offered both roles, the Brando role and the Martin Sheen role. And so he wanted to take the Brando role, and he called Clint Eastwood and said, hey, would you consider taking the Sheen role? And they were both laughing, like, oh, you just want this part because you only have to do 2 weeks in the jungle. But those two were considering doing Apocalypse Now, if you can believe it.
Well, I still want to see Clint Eastwood do Ibsen, but we'll get to that in a little bit. So, and also another guy that he had to work with. How was McQueen working with Mr. Movie Stance, Yul Brynner?
Yul Brynner,
well, everyone's favorite Cajun.
Yul at the time was well. In the Magnificent Seven, you had a lot of these young upstarts on the film, and Yul Brynner was already an established star. He got his Academy Award nod for
King and I.
I think the King and I.
Yep.
And you know, he walked onto that set with a big entourage, a beautiful a woman that he was about to marry, and the thing that really stuck out to McQueen and it got on his nerves was Brynner would stop, snap his fingers, hold out his hand. Somebody would put a cigarette in his hand, and then another guy would come and light it.
Wow. Man.
And McQueen thought that was, you know, just the essence of arrogance, and he was going to bring him down a notch. And so he conspired with the other guys. But the beauty of this was is that McQueen, being a street guy, was smarter than the other guys. So he got the other guys. So, you know, McQueen definitely – I tried to take down him a notch or two, but he also got the other guys in on it. But he left the other guys kind of in the dust as well. So it was a master stroke on McQueen's part. And so, some of those things, like, you know, you'd see in the film, you know, they're in the wagon and they're rolling up the street, and McQueen's got a line of dialogue, but he's also shaking these shotgun shells and in his ear and drawing attention away from Brynner.
Mm-hmm.
But the best one was there was a scene there where Yul Brynner was standing on a dirt mound, and Yul was kind of a small guy. And so McQueen had this part where he was walking back and forth, not circling Brynner, but walking back and forth, talking to him. And Brynner had built himself a little dirt mound to stand on, so he appeared taller. But every time that McQueen would walk by, he'd kick away a little bit of that dirt. So by the end of the scene, you know, Brynner was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. That's the kind of stuff McQueen was doing throughout the whole movie.
I remember showing The Magnificent Seven to a friend who had not seen it before, and his description of Yul Brynner when it came to movement was, when it comes to walking, he leads with his groin.
That's funny.
Now, looking at his IMDb, I know 1963 was a big year for McQueen because he was able to tap into the male movie-going audience with The Great Escape and the female-going audience with Love with the Proper Stranger.
Right. Yes. And you know, a lot of people think of McQueen as an action movie star, but if you look at his filmography, you can see every film is a little bit different than the other. So he did, you know, that Great Escape was an action film, obviously. The next film that he did, though, after that was Soldier in the Rain, which was an outright comedy. He wasn't very good in it, I don't think. And then he did Love with the Proper Stranger, which was a romantic lead. And, you know, he knew that that was good for his career. And then the next one was a heavy drama, Baby, the Rain Must Fall. And then the next one is The Cincinnati Kid, which is, you know, a car drama. So, again, he had the most successful action films, but he did try his hand at other types of roles. And he was successful to a point, but you know, he should be giving more credit than what he has been given in the past.
More than just tough guy roles. So, did the streak, if I remember right, the streak of the Big Five, didn't it start with Cincinnati Kid, from Cincinnati Kid to Bullet?
That's right. Yeah, Cincinnati Kid. Let me see if I have it right. Yeah.
Yep.
Cincinnati Kid, Nevada Smith.
Yep.
Sam Pebbles.
Yep.
Thomas Crown, Bullet.
That's not bad. That's not a bad stretch.
Well, and not only that, but each film was subsequently bigger than the other in terms of money.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Bullet, this is a very famous case of creative studio accounting. Some believe that it made $80 million in 1968 monies. And I actually even talked to the producer of that film, who said, yes, they got a big check from Warner Brothers when they checked into it. He wouldn't tell me how much it was. But he said there was some creative accounting going on. But it's believed that that film grossed, like you said, $80 million, which would be, you'd take that times. That would be like a $500 million film today, $600 million film today. So that's how big it was. It was a huge film. It launched him from movie star to superstar, if there is such a distinction.
Right. And I know he got an Academy Award nomination for The Sand Pebbles, and I know there was a lot of brushback about him wanting to do, from studios, about doing the Thomas Crown Affair.
That's correct. Yeah, Sean Connery was actually pegged to do that.
Ooh.
And Steve McQueen didn't actually, when he became famous, he didn't actually have to fight for that many roles. He was offered about 20 scripts a week, if you can believe that. And but his wife knew, who was great for his career, Neil, said, "You know what? It's a shame that the movie studios don't want you for this." And he goes, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, you know, Sean Connery's going to get this part, and that really should be yours. That will really enhance your career." And so she played this mind game with him to the point where he actually went to the director, Norman Jewison, and pretty much asked for the part, which he didn't do again in his filmography. And so he gave him the part, and McQueen just basically said, you know, he's a rebel, but he's a different kind of rebel. He wears three-piece suits, and he goes, "I think I can do this." And so he pulled it off. I mean, it was a really great, stylish film, and it cemented his popularity with women, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the next one was Bullet, which was an action flick, and that just put him through the roof. So, but Thomas Crown, as you know, was remade, and again, another feather in his cap.
Yep, and I know he was one that he wanted to do his own stunts whenever possible. And I know, I know he took up polo to do Thomas Crown Affair, and of course, the motorcycle jump was always a discussion in The Great Escape, and how much driving he was able to do in Bullet. Do you have an idea of a percentage of how much driving he was able to do in Bullet?
Yes, and actually, I've talked to both. There were two stuntmen on Bullet, not drivers, but stuntmen. There was a stunt for the airport, if you recall. That was Lauren
Yep.
James. He ran underneath a plane. That was not McQueen. And then in Bullet, the stunt coordinator, Carrie Lofton, told me that McQueen had wrecked a couple of cars. And that, yeah, he wanted to be the tough guy and do all the stunts, but, you know, movie insurance just prohibits you from doing that. So with McQueen, they tricked him. They gave him a late call time, and then Buddy can started doing the really hardcore stunts. And but the trick to that is, I can't give a percentage, but the trick is when the rear view mirror is down and you can't see McQueen's face, that's the stunt driver. But when it's up and you can see McQueen's face, that's McQueen driving.
Right. And didn't he really wanted to do the jump in The Great Escape, correct?
He did. And again, that was another case where insurance would prevent him from doing that, because if he wrecked himself, then the movie was done. But, you know, he brought Buddy Ekins. And when I interviewed Buddy Ekins, he goes, "Well, why'd they bring me to Germany if I wasn't going to do the stunt?" So I think that was always pre-planned. But there are some great pictures in the book that show McQueen up high in the air doing a jump on some. It's not the motorcycle that jumps over the fence, but he's off-roading in another motorcycle, and he's a good 6-7 feet in the air, and he's up there. So there's no doubt that he could have done it, but you know, you don't want to chance that on a movie.
Mm-hmm. And I know he early on got into auto racing, or as I wrote in my notes, non-Hollywood stuff, and it became, you know, one of his first big passion projects was, when did he get the idea to do Le Mans?
Well, it took 10 years to come to fruition. He wanted to do Le Mans in 1959, and he wanted it to co-star Brigitte Bardot. And I know this because I have an old Hedda Hopper column that he used to do. And he announced that. That's when he made his first production company. But he just didn't have the juice to get it off the ground, as he liked to say. So when so after Bullet, that's when he put Le Mans into effect. And so that movie came out he filmed it in 70, and it came out in 71. And so you see his real passion for the sport. Unfortunately, the movie, I always call it, it's a really bad movie, but if you talk to an auto guy, it's the best movie in the world.
Yep.
So
yeah, it's good footage, and that's about it.
Right.
Yeah. And I enjoyed the two collaborations he did with Sam Peckinpah, with Junior Bonner, especially, and Junior Bonner doesn't get enough credit. The Getaway is a fun popcorn action film. But, you know, Peckinpah always liked to do the aging guy with one more chance at glory. He had revisited that theme all the way back to Ride the High Country. And I really like Junior Bonner, and it seems like it was also an opportunity for McQueen to try a new form of action with rodeo work.
Right. Well, you know, it was McQueen referred to two movies in his career, Thomas Crown Affair and Junior Bonner. And it wasn't so much the action for the rodeo, because believe it or not, because of insurance purposes, he had to ride a mechanical bull. So the close-ups that you see on McQueen are a mechanical, and he felt like his balls were cut off because of that. But the movie gave him an opportunity to be a part of an ensemble, because after Le Mans, everything was on his shoulders. So he basically, I think his quote was, "I no longer want to be the chief. I just want to be an Indian." And so with Junior Bonner, it gave him the opportunity to work with a cast, focus on being an actor again. And, you know, it was a beautiful film. But unfortunately, it just wasn't very successful. It was one of three rodeo movies that came out that summer.
Yeah, that's timing.
And then, you know, again, the expectation that, you know, McQueen should be in an action, which his next film was, which was The Getaway.
And Ally McGraw along with it.
Yes, and that, of course, that changed his life. So they, you know, they started an affair on that film. McQueen was finalizing his divorce to Neil, and she was married, of course, to Robert Evans, very, very powerful producer. And they had their romantic fling on the set, and McQueen had never really had to fight for a woman before, and so he basically took her away from Robert Evans, and so that caused problems for her career, and it caused problems for him, because at that time Hollywood didn't like him, and there was talk that Papillon, his next film, he should have won an Academy Award for, but because actors didn't like him because he was a selfish guy, he didn't get the nod for that, so it cost him in a lot of different ways.
It's funny, as I was going through the book and I was going through my notes, it seems like there are moments by reading it that McQueen, like all of us, are kind of a person of contradictions, where, you know, one quote I'll see, he enjoyed seeing himself on a screen in a particular film, or he doesn't like to watch himself at all. He wants the Hollywood attention, but he also wants to have a non-Hollywood lifestyle. Even something about, you know, something as simple as the subject of marriage.
Right.
It was just interesting that you were able to point out the both sides of the coin.
Right. Well, and that's why McQueen is endlessly fascinating, because he is so complex. He changed his mind. The thing about marriage, you know, is really, really striking, because, you know, he talked about how he's a one woman guy. That's it. That's the whole ball game for me. And then, you know, I mean, he was known for having multiple affairs. But in his mind, those things didn't mean anything, and his heart was with his wife. But obviously, you know, she didn't see it that way. But that's how he saw things. Like, you know, this is part and parcel of being a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
And so those contradictions, I felt, had to be pointed out. And but, you know, he was a movie star, and he wanted to take every advantage that he could.
Right.
That was just his personality.
And how was he working with Paul Newman on The Towering Inferno?
Well, you see the pictures there. And I actually have pictures from a lady named Patty Vonnegut, who's become a friend of mine. And she was an eyewitness. And I was asking her how they got along. And she said, oh, my God, it was like they were old two college buddies just hanging out, just having fun. She said you could tell they really liked each other. But before that, before the movie got made, you know, they had history with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. They were built to star together, and this was just right after Bullet. So McQueen was the hotter star, but Paul Newman had been around a bit longer. So there was a question of billing, and they could never get past that. As a matter of fact, McQueen kept saying, well, let's just flip a coin, let's flip a coin. And Newman didn't want to do that. And so the part went to Paul, or to Robert Redford, and he became a huge star. And I always felt that McQueen would have been fantastic in that role. But then we get to Tower Inferno, and they've agreed on billing, and that is McQueen's going to be lower on the left, but first, and then Newman on the right, higher. But then there was also the question of the script. It's Sterling Siliphant who wrote this, in a very, 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 very famous Hollywood scriptwriter, said McQueen read the script and noticed that Paul, I think, had 12 more lines than he did. And so Sterling Siliphant was out on a deep-sea fishing expedition, and McQueen had him called in the shore and had him not only change it, but, like, he wanted them to have the same exact amount of lines.
Oh, my gosh.
No more, no less. Now it gets even better. So when they're on the set, Siliphant said McQueen would then come and change Paul's – come in and talk with Siliphant and change Paul's lines and weaken them. And then Paul would – then he'd leave, and then Paul would come in to Siliphant and say, why are you changing my lines? And Siliphant couldn't tell Paul Newman that McQueen wanted to weaken them. And then when they were filming, McQueen was on set when Newman was filming, and he was looking through the little box, you know, that and he was just there every step of the way, kind of hounding them. So it was an interesting contradiction.
Yeah, I think of the story of Newman and Redford when they would exchange the car that became a block of metal and a piece of art without ever saying a word, and it almost has that feel. Although it seemed like McQueen had a part of him that was a hornet's nest you didn't want to poke too hard.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, this was for all the marbles in terms of McQueen, because this was an opportunity for him to catch up to him when he was on the set of Somebody Up There Likes Me. Now, interestingly enough, after the Tower Inferno, he felt he had caught up to Newman, and he had just taken off for a couple of years. He goes into self-imposed exile. So it almost was as if he got burned out trying to catch up to Paul Newman.
Well, and we had mentioned before about him having issues with insurance and being able to do stunts, and he finally did a cinematic middle finger by working on Dixie Dynamite.
Yes. That was, again, during his period of his self-imposed exile. And Bud Eakins, his buddy and stunt double, was coordinating a drive-in movie fair that you couldn't, you know. So McQueen was really bored now. He had all the money that he wanted and was doing nothing but laying around all day drinking beer and smoking pot. And so he found out that Bud was doing this thing, and Bud said, I need an extra writer. And so McQueen said, yeah, sure. So here's this guy who just made $14 million from the Tower Inferno, making like $156 a day, doing stunts for this drive-in movie. So it was quite the contradiction.
And how did he get obsessed with an enemy of the people?
That was an interesting thing. In 1971, he signed a three-picture deal with First Artist.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, again, right after Le Mans. He needed something big. He needed some security. And so he signed this three-picture deal. So it was like the old United Artists deal with Charlie Chaplin. So these group of stars, it was McQueen, Barbara Streisand, Sidney Poitier, Dustin Hoffman. They could make any film they wanted, but for only $3.3 million. That was the budget.
Hmm.
So The Getaway was the first one under that obligation, and that was $3.3 million. But that was in 72. Now it was 1977. And, you know, and this was after Tower Inferno, where he was the hottest movie star in the world. And the people that owned those two movies, that contract, wanted him to make, you know, those two movies, fulfill his obligations, because, you know, he was a hot star and he was going to bring money to them. So they were pressing him really, really hard. And so they pressed him too hard to the point where they pushed him too far. So what he said was, okay, fine, I'm going to do Henrik Ibsen. It's not. It's a beautiful actor's part, but it's not going to make a bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did that movie out of spite. And but it backfired because the movie was permanently shelved. It didn't get a proper release, and it gave him a ton of bad publicity.
Yep. And I have a DVD copy of it, thanks to Warner Archives.
Yes.
Yeah,
I do too. And he's not bad.
No.
He's not bad at all. He holds his ground, but it was a movie. It's interesting. Today, there would have been an outlet for that.
Yeah.
Back then, it was just the movie theater. But today, it would have been released to HBO or something like that. And
right.
He would have been celebrated as you know, quote unquote, an actor. And you see that happen quite a bit today. I seem to refer to the Hugh Jackman film that he did for HBO, where he played a principal
in Education, right?
Yeah, and he was great in that. But you know, it's not Wolverine. So
yep.
Anyway, he got a lot of bad publicity for that. Didn't really so when that got shelved, you know, he took another couple of years off. So he wasn't seen on screen for 5 years, which is a lifetime for an audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
almost unheard of. The same kind of like with John Lennon when John Lennon took that break for 5 years.
Yeah.
People just was like, it's unheard of, you know. Nowadays, everybody does it, you know. But back then, unheard of.
Yeah, you had to almost, you know, whether it was music or film, there had to be something every year or every 2 years, like a
yes.
like clockwork. Now, folks today are used to, and I don't, I use the term loosely, but geezer action heroes, you know, your post Liam Neeson thing, but you had mentioned Sean Connery, who probably was one of the first ones to do it. McQueen's last two films, when he was 50 and sick, was he sick on Tom Horn as well?
He wasn't. Well, he was sick, but didn't know what he had, and they did examinations, and he had a collapsed lung. But the interesting thing about the type of cancer they had called mesothelioma is that it's in the lining of the lungs. So when you do an X-ray, they could not find it. So I believe that he was probably sick during then, but he didn't know about it. And then, of course, on The Hunter, he there's a quote in the book where he says, you know, in Chicago, I knew I was sick. And then, of course, right after he filmed, like 7 days after he filmed The Hunter, he goes to Cedars-Sinai, and then they diagnose him with mesothelioma.
Mm. And those two, what do you think of those two films? Because I think that's not a bad double feature. I mean, he's done far, far better, but for what they were, it's pretty good popcorn fare.
You know, I saw both in the movie theater. I was 16 years old when both of those movies came out. And Tom Horn feels it's wonderful acting, but the movie itself feels a bit disjointed, and I know why, because they were shooting from two different scripts.
Mm.
And they were trying to do something artistic. It holds up well. At the time, I remember being disappointed, and then when I saw The Hunter, I definitely felt disappointed.
Okay.
It felt cheap. It felt like a TV movie, and the music was really kind of strange, and just the production of it just looked really cheap. But you know, certainly people appreciated the fact that he was poking fun at himself, but you know, I was used to McQueen as the action movie star, but I was too young to understand that then. I was 16. I was like, I want the kick-ass McQueen.
Yeah.
Where is he? And so, you know, with time, knowing what I know now, it's like, okay, this is there, but there are flashes of brilliance in there where he just gives a great look. But,
yeah, I was just talking to my wife this week about the corn cobs, because I think that's a pretty, I mean, there's some decent stunt work in The Hunter, and climaxed with the chase and the car going from the out of the corn cobs into the drink.
Right, and sadly McQueen didn't do any of that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. This was the first film where he basically said, "I'm not doing any of that stuff, Lauren. It's all yours."
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, you mentioned you had done a biography on another person who winds up at near the end of McQueen's life and gave him a gift.
Right. And you're referring to Billy Graham.
Yeah.
I'm assuming.
Yep.
Yeah. At the end of his life, Steve McQueen, and this is before he was diagnosed with cancer, started going to church. and started taking pilot lessons from a guy named Sammy Mason in Santa Paula, California, which is considered the antique capital of the world. And so he was getting lessons from Sammy, and Steve had always been searching for a father figure all of his life because his father abandoned him. And Sammy was a World War II pilot, was like 10 or 15 years older than Steve, and just held himself in a different way that McQueen really respected. And one day McQueen said to him, "Sammy, there's something different about you, but I can't put my finger on it." And Sammy said, "Well, Steve, I'm a born-again Christian." And from that moment on, McQueen didn't start emulating him, but he wanted to please Sammy. And he said, "Sammy, can I go to church with you? Sammy, can I do this?" And so he started going to church, and he became a born-again Christian. And the way I know this was because he tapped the pastor on the shoulder. His name's Leonard DeWitt. And Leonard, he said, "Hey, pastor, could I have a lunch with you?" And he said, "Sure." So they had lunch at the airport grill. And DeWitt said Steve had grilled him hard on the Christian life with the hard questions, and you know he answered them. And then Steve said, "Okay, well, I'm satisfied." And DeWitt said, "Well, Steve, I have just one question." And Steve said, "You want to know if I'm a born again Christian?" And he said, "Yes, that's all I want to know." And he said, "Well, when you said your prayer a couple weeks ago, and you asked people, you invited people, you know, to give their lives to Christ," he goes, "I did." And so from that point on, you know, Steve kind of became a changed person. And anyway, so he gets sick like 6 months after that. And then, you know, it's very apparent he's going to die. And so he's been requesting to see Billy Graham for quite some time. And Billy had just finished a crusade in Japan and was able to fly to California and go see Steve. And, you know, Billy had written that, you know, he thought that he was going to witness to Steve. And he said, "In fact, Steve was witnessing to me." And then at the end of their two-hour meeting, they're about to say a prayer, and Steve says, "Well, let me grab my Bible." And he couldn't find it. And Billy said, "Well, here's mine." And he hands over his Bible to Steve. And this is a Bible I've held in my hands, and I've looked in it, and it had the phone numbers of Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon in there. And so that became Steve's proudest possession. And he carried it with him to Mexico. And when he passed away and they lifted up the sheet, you know, to go get him, to take him to the morgue, he was clutching the Bible that Billy Graham had given him.
Man. And speaking of which, so the book you wrote about Billy Graham, has that been released?
The
Man
the
I Knew?
That I wrote about Billy?
Yeah.
That will come out in April. And I did that with Pastor Greg Laurie, if you know that name. He's a big evangelist in Orange County. He runs Harvest Ministries. So we did a series of books on icons. And the first one was Steve McQueen, and the second one was Johnny Cash, and then the third one was Billy Graham. And they're all intertwined when you read it. So it's Billy was I knew nothing about Billy Graham, but I have the greatest respect for him now because the work that he did over a period of 60 years is as much as any United States president that we've ever had. So there have been – I've been to several United States presidents' libraries, and I can tell you that Billy's work far surpassed anybody's.
Nice. The book is Steve McQueen in His Own Words, and it's written and compiled by Marshall Terrell. Am I saying that right?
That's correct.
Okay, not Terrell. I'm curious because I was going through your list. I have to ask, what did you think of the films of Ken Norton?
The films of Ken Norton?
Yes.
Oh, he was terrible. I always used to give him a hard time. I'd always call him Bandingo, and but you know, Ken was a really fun guy. I loved Ken. He was just a big, playful kid. But I'd always call him Drum or Mandingo, or you know, I'd say, I teased him mercilessly. But he'd always get me back. Ken was the kind of guy that would be in a room, like we did a lot of signings together, and he'd be in a room and he'd fart really loud, and then And then he'd shift his eyes and then point at me. And, like, nobody would ever believe that a superstar would be farting. So, obviously, so everybody always thought it was me.
How did he get involved with Mandingo and drum?
You know what? I seem to – well, he was a big he was in the public eye. I just remember the if I recall right, was it – who was the producer on Mandingo? Wasn't it like
– I believe it was Dino.
Okay, that's what I thought. It was a big flamboyant guy. You know, that was his style. He'd pick all these wild figures or characters, you know. I think that's how he got it. I mean, it was just a matter of like, oh, this guy would fit this part. He would look like a big, you know, this is what the part requires. So at the time, I'm sure it was just either him or OJ. You know, that was probably it.
Right. And, well,
I think OJ was doing the Towering Inferno. And Ken got this part, if I'm not mistaken.
That could make sense. And I was, because I know OJ's first film was The Klansman, and there's guns and a car in that we won't get into. But
I'll tell you another funny story about Ken. We did a lot of book signings together, and we did one here in Arizona. We did a lot of signings and boxing matches. Because people would just, because they, you know, books are an impulsive buy.
Yep.
And like, oh, there's Ken Norton. Oh, and there's his book. I'm going to get it. So we went to, Native American boxing was big at that time when the book came out. The book came out in 2000. And so we went here at the Salt River Pima Indian. And so the Native Americans viewed Ken like as this grand old warrior. And we go into this boardroom. It's just that it's before everything. They want to meet him because they want to do a lot of stuff with him in the future, but they want to meet him. And we get into the boardroom. It's just me, him, and my co-author, Mike Fitzgerald. And Mike and I are both white. And it's these 15 Native Americans in this boardroom. They're all sitting at this table. And he sits right next to this chief. And Mike and I are sitting, like, behind them, but not at the table. And nobody's saying anything because Ken's just so intimidating to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally he looks at the chief and says, "Why do I always feel like the white man's trying to keep us apart?" And those guys bust out laughing, and it was like the perfect icebreaker.
Nice.
Yeah. That's the kind of guy he was.
Excellent. What are you working on now?
Well, I am working on a passion project about a recording studio in Georgia. It's called Reel to Reel Studios. And I'm friendly with the bassist of the group Collective Soul. His name is Will Turpin. And Will's dad, Bill Turpin, owned this studio. And so I'm doing it's a photo book with a brief history, but I just turned in a proposal for a book on the Dallas Cowboys, America's team from the 70s and the 80s. And it would be with a lot of the former players, like an oral biography. So we'll see if they accept that or not.
Okay. Well, tell the cheerleaders about my shows.
Well, and we are actually devoting a special chapter to the cheerleaders.
Thank you.
I did some research. I found out that their famous poster, remember from 76?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It outsold any piece of memorabilia that Dallas had ever put out to that time.
Yep.
And it's now in the Smithsonian Institute.
Well, yeah, I just got thumbs so I could turn pages and raise my knuckles, so that'll be fun.
Yeah, and that's the idea, is to make it a fun book, because they were a cast of characters, and you know, they all, like 80-95% of them, disliked Tom Landry at the time. What they didn't know, Landry later said in retirement, I did not want to be friendly with my ballplayers because I knew one day I'd have to cut them, and I didn't want to have to be, you know, that would be disappointing to me. So he took the tough route.
He did. And he had the spiffiest hats on the sidelines.
Yes, they were. They were definitely. Yeah, fedora hats.
It's old. It's an old lost. It's a lost art. So,
yeah. Are you a basketball fan at all?
I'm obnoxious Detroit sports guy. So all of the gray I have in my hair is because of the Lions. But, you know, I was insufferable when the Pistons were actually good. So,
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I did a book on Pistol Pete Maravich, and that was a lot of fun because I love old school basketball. I love the idea of those guys playing a full half, going into the locker room, cracking open a beer or a cigarette.
Or the
colorful as that.
Yep. Or the famous halftime locker room photo of Len Dawson with a soda and a smoke. Well, and that was, you know what, that's actually not a bad, we were talking off air about Fred Williamson, but the 70s was a good time to be a pro athlete and be in the movies, whether it was something with a big budget like Mandingo or something like, I think it was like the, oh gosh, I have a couple of them where it's a group of like seven different guys.
You know what's funny about that? I was just looking up that story the other day. I know what you're talking about. Carl Eller was in that.
But
there was something like that. It was, hold on a sec.
I know.
It came out in 1973. And my buddy was like a little liar. He was coming over. We lived in a suburb of Washington, D.C., and you never went into Washington, D.C.
Right.
It was rough.
I got it.
He said that, what's it called?
The Black Six.
That's it.
Gene Washington, Joe Green, Mercury Morris, Len Barney, Carl Eller, and Willie Lanier.
Yeah, Len Barney is a Detroiter for you.
Yeah, yeah, right? But they're not doing August Wilson anytime soon.
I was busting his balls like a couple weeks ago about that, because he lied. He said, our family actually went into D.C. to go see that movie. And, like, I saw the trailer of it the other day. It just looked atrocious. And then I started looking at the back history of it. It was filmed in Los Angeles, of course.
Yep.
In the off season. But I can't even imagine if those guys got paid anything at all.
Yeah, that's curious. Yeah, otherwise, why would you do it? So this is the guy, the director would later do Butterfly. He'd inflict Pia Zadora on us.
Did you see the Eddie Murphy movie? What was it?
Dolomite is My Name?
No. That was one of the best things he's ever done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we were happy Indianapolis got some love for it. But yeah, that was one. Murphy, he's also one where if he actually follows direction, because even something like Mr. Curtis, which was, a bit soppy, but he was working with a director like Bruce Beresford. But I think a number of those comics, Sandler's another one that I think I hit him hard with, is when you're actually taking direction as opposed to, we're going to let the camera roll and you just do 20 things and we'll pick the best one. But yeah, it's a valid. And Craig Brewer, of course, who did Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan. He's it's a nice Valentine to that era. I think that and Ed Wood are a fun double feature about low budget movie making.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. That's a great idea. Yeah. That's amazing.
So. The book is Steve McQueen in his own words. And Marshall, I really, really appreciate your time on this. And I can't wait to see what you're going to write and talk about next.
Well, I appreciate you having me on your show.
My epic chat with author Marshall Terrell, the author of Steve McQueen in His Own Words. That's being published through Dalton Watson Fine Books. So make a good gift for a film fan or for yourself. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before I get to what I watched this week, as well as what you watched this past week, shameless plug, the 1940s radio production of It's a Wonderful Life is happening at Richmond Civic Theater next weekend. That is December 5th and 6th. And then there will be some streaming opportunities to see the show. You go to gorct.org for tickets and streaming times and all that good stuff. It is, like I said, it's a Wonderful Life, but it's being done as if it is a radio play. So you have one actor playing George, one actress playing Mary, and then you have two men and a woman playing everything else, including yours truly. I play the radio announcer Freddie Fillmore, as well as the voices of Potter, Uncle Billy, Peter Bailey, Joseph the Angel, and many, many others. So if you've never seen this before, it is a fun, fun show. I got to direct this actual script 4 times in my career, and I'm happy to be on the other side of it as an actor. So, and it's a socially distanced production, so because it's a radio play, so we're distant, and it's a lot of fun. So if you get a chance, come out to Richmond or go to gorct.org for streaming information. Okay, so my nights have been taken away because of rehearsals, and that's all right. But a new film out from Magnolia Films called Collective. This is a documentary set in Romania about the power of journalism, which we kind of need these days, you know, because of, you know, that darn interwebs. But this it starts with a deadly nightclub fire that killed 37 young people, some trampled to death, and others that wound up dying from their burns, as well as a lot of them dying in the hospitals because the hospitals were not equipped to take care of certain bacteria and burn victims. And what the press has to do to get to the truth and get to why medication was being diluted, why were these hospitals not equipped for to take care of these victims. And of course, going through the documentary, you have this within a span of a few weeks, you have this deadly fire, which and there is footage of it. It is really, really upsetting. And if you're, of course, an American music fan, you think of the fire that happened at the Great White Concert up in New England, had that vibe about it. But you have that moment, the head of a pharmaceutical firm dying mysteriously, some say suicide, and then the minister of health resigns all within weeks apart. So that doesn't add up well. And so you get a look at reporters on the beat, putting the feet to the fire of those who deserve it. So there is that aspect of it. Like I said, it could be like Spotlight, but it's actually a documentary. But there's a lot of good camera footage, and I have to give props that they were able to get a lot of footage of the new health minister who has to answer the questions from some very relentless reporting done in Romania. So anyway, it's if you want to feel good about the press and what they're doing, and this is in Romania, go check out Collective, courtesy of Magnolia Films. From Film Movement Classics, this is a title that I've always heard about and have not gotten a chance to experience, and I'm glad that I did. It's a drama called The Killing Floor, and this was made for public television, and it's set in Chicago in World War I, when two African-American men migrate from the Deep South to Chicago and wind up working at a slaughterhouse. And there's that story of it, the relationship between the two men, although mostly it's on the character of Frank, played well by Damian Leek. And there's these guys are approached by recruiters for them to join the local union, threats of a strike. And it's an interesting aspect of unions and how much pull they had, especially in the during World War I and in Chicago and in the meatpacking industry. But it talks about not only the racism in the city, because yes, even though they left for the north, there's still racism everywhere, but as well as racism within not only the stockyard, the slaughterhouse itself, but even within the union. So very complex stuff. And when the Frank character is able to move up into a black union organizer and is feeling torn between what's right and what's just, and what to do. So this is an early film directing effort from actor Bill Duke, who we know from everything from Car Wash, Commando, Predator, but he was also directing as far back as the late 70s and has done a number of TV and films, most notably Rage in Harlem, Deep Cover, Sister Act 2, Hoodlum, Cemetery Club, and many others. And this is one of his early efforts, and it was made for, if I remember right, American Masters on PBS. As I said, good performance from Damian Leek and some familiar faces. Probably the big name at this time was Moses Gunn, who'd been in everything from Shaft to the original Rollerball. But you see a young Alfre Woodard, a young John Mahoney, a young Dennis Farina, young Ted Levine. And it's a really good look at the power and the complexity of the union, as well as union and employee relations, and really Chicago during World War One. So, and there's a number of special features we're checking out. That is Film Movement Classics. Go check out The Killing Floor. Also out on video from Corinth is a film called a Latvian film called Mellow Mud, about two teenagers who living basically on their own for the most part. Their grandmother is a part of the household, but not a lot. And what happens when the grandmother dies and they don't tell anybody? The film gave me a little bit of vibe of S.E. Hinton, especially the film and the novel Tex, about two more kids that are basically living on their own, trying to dodge the social worker. And in her case, the oldest daughter named Rhea is trying to be a parent and a teenager and a sister all at the same time of her younger brother, Robus. And as time goes on, we find out she wants to enter an English competition that is happening in London. Even though she's not the best student, grade-wise, she has a real passion for this. And it's a nice balance of seeing this 17-year-old girl having to take charge of her life as well as her brother's, as well as dodging all the circumstances from the outside world. It's good rooted performances from everybody involved. Even there's an aspect of it that you see coming a mile away, and it didn't really bother you as much as her mentor is her fairly young 20-something good-looking male English teacher. You kind of know where that's going. That being said, knowing those scenes, I didn't expect, and I should have seen the connection when she goes to London, and we find out, of course, that her mother is living out there. The mother had abandoned the family. So anyway, good solid drama from the film Mellow Mud on Corinth Home Video. And that's as far as the old new titles or new on video. Because it was Thanksgiving, I try to have a tradition of on Thanksgiving Eve this week. I got to watch and revisit the Martin Scorsese documentary The Last Waltz, the final concert film of the band, or as it turned out to be, the final concert of the band involving Robbie Robertson. Just to be fair and balanced, check out the Levon Helm documentary because you really should. And I'm a big fan of the band, even though it is a kind of lopsided story looking at Robbie Robertson. Oh, and the other guys he played with. So, but really good music, really good footage. And I'm a Scorsese freak, of course. And by the way, speaking of Scorsese, The Irishman is now out on video courtesy of Criterion Collection, waiting on mine in the mail. And I had Emma pick the film. Well, she picked the film this week. Hopefully next week I'll go into a little more about what we did for Thanksgiving with my annual Thanksgiving guest. But Emma picked The Fantastic Mr. Fox to watch as a family on Thanksgiving evening because, and she kept thinking of the dinner sequence that the fox has with his animal friends. And it's just fun to revisit and still holds up. And so we had a good time here at the Soci household. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Long Thanksgiving weekend, still more movies to watch, and let's find out what you watched over the last week, and maybe you will be inspired. We start, as usual, with my buddy Eric via email. He revisited Raiders of the Lost Ark, which he deemed smashing, of course. And that's a great example of something old and something new back in 1981. I had forgotten that the film was at time considered a sleeper because theater owners in 1981 were looking forward to Superman 2 as the big hit. And Raiders was a runaway hit as well, but even more so. Anyway, also revisiting 1964's The Killers. Extra good if you like it pulpy, he says. And you get to see Ronald Reagan as a villain. That was his last film, if I remember right. Made for TV, he watched The Crown, which a lot of people have been doing, so thank you there, Eric. Going over to Facebook, we start with my friend Ron, who says the other half, simple and charming, but the lead actress nails it. Michelle writes, The Twelfth Man. Ryan writes, Terminator, Dark Fate. Lou Harry writes, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, The Personal History of David Copperfield, The Stand-In, Sound of Metal, and 20 minutes of Hillbilly Elegy. Just 20. I believe you can go online and read Lou Harry's review of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. You'll want to check that out. Megan writes, Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey, and then in all caps, with 5 exclamation points, amazing. As well as Bill and Ted Face the Music. Abdul Kim Shabazz, who's been on this show, he writes Nixon. He and I have a strange love of Oliver Stone's film Nixon because, well, it's you know, this is post JFK, and Oliver Stone treats Nixon like a Shakespearean tragic character, and you almost feel bad for him, almost. And Anthony Hopkins is really good, and believe it or not, and a really solid bench of supporting players. Bill writes, I introduced my better half to The Long Kiss Goodnight, which she had not only never seen, but she didn't know know about the premise. Gina Davis, Samuel L. Jackson, how can you beat that? Well, you can. Also, I agree to her request to watch Enola Holmes, or as I like to call it, 11 Meets Superman. Thank you, Bill. Mary writes, The Man with Two Brains and A Night at the Opera. Joan writes, The Iron Lady, because I binged on season 4 of The Crown and felt needy. It's all right, Joan. It's all right, Roz. Devin writes, 13 Going on 30, Finding Dory, Love, Simon, and Paper Towns. Britt writes, Home Alone, The Grinch, 2018, Jingle Jangle, The Princess Switched Again, The Christmas Prince, The Christmas Prince Royal Wedding, and The Christmas Prince Royal Baby. White Christmas, Malibu Rescue, and Malibu Rescue 2, as well as Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2. I'm assuming you picked up the subtle nuances and not revisiting the first Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Okay. Henry writes, Die Hard, yes. Enola Holmes, entertaining. And The Personal History of David Copperfield, so-so, but some great performances. Andy writes, Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, City of God, The Five Bloods, and Deliverance. Hopefully, you didn't do Bloods and Deliverance together. That's a hard combo. Daniel writes, Under the Volcano, Swoon, Young at Heart, Magic, Midnight Lace, Fat City. I love Fat City. The Macintosh Man, The Bible, Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, Young Man with a Horn, and Dodsworth. Somebody went through a John Huston stretch. That's pretty good. Michael writes, The Bad News Bears, not The Bad News Bees. Well, anyway, Catherine writes, Home for the Holidays, which is happening because it's Thanksgiving week. David writes, James and the Giant Peach, just finished teaching the book, so we compare it and contrast. Very good, David. Kara writes, Knives Out and The Craft. Nikki writes, A Quiet Place. Eric writes, The Boys in the Band, new version. Wonderful adaptation with strong performances all around, though I had a hard time separating Jim Parsons from his Sheldon character. Zachary Quinto was brilliant. Then National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. My wife had never seen it and now has no plans of seeing it again. It's all right. She's fine. It's good to be fine. Jay writes, I watched the latest Shaft and paid to see the New Mutants. The other week, 7 of us rented a theater and watched Tenet. New Mutants was the only disappointment. Very slow. All right, Jay, you're the first person I know that is actually, I think, first person I know that has actually rented a movie theater. So congrats on that. I'm assuming everybody's safe. So Julie writes, Willow, back when Val Kilmer was awesome. All caps. Dustin writes, Dracula, 1931. Ball of Fire, 1941. And Irving Berlin's Holiday Inn, the Broadway musical from 2017. James writes, The Original Karate Kid. Bruno writes, Once Upon a Time in the West. Ed writes, It's a good day to die hard. I cannot recommend it. I know. Nick writes, Nick Rogers, Home for the Holidays, Athlete A, Professor, Boys State, King of Staten Island, The Nest, So I Married an Axe Murderer, and Shirley. Stephen writes, Black Orpheus and Mystery of the Wax Museum, plus 2 episodes of season 2 of His Dark Materials, and John finally finished out The Crown. Congratulations. Taylor writes, Sweeney Todd with Ray Winstone, Laura, British Intelligence Service with Boris Karloff, Interstellar in IMAX, wow, 2001 A Space Odyssey, and two Charlie Chan movies. Brian Wright's Train to Busan plus presents Peninsula and The Right Stuff. Mark Wright's Trial of Chicago 7, My Respect for Mr. Cohen, continues to rise. Kim Wright's Just Getting Started and The Way I See It documentary. Jeff Wright's The Innocents. Joe Shearer writes Soul, Uncle Frank, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Stardust, and Ammonite. Sorry. Robert writes Rossi's Christ Stopped at Ebola, Leo McCarey's Make Way for Tomorrow, Jules Dassin and Norman Z. McLeod's The Canterville Ghost, The Personal History of David Copperfield, and The Life Ahead. Thank you, Robert. Stacy writes, late to the game, E and I watched a delightful, hilarious Palm Springs. Kids and E watched Big. Kids and I watched Elf and Home Alone. Kids watched Boss Baby and some My Little Pony movie. Thank you, Stacy. Hang in there. Mason writes, The Day After and Blade Runner for an 80s apocalypse binge. Ooh. And then The Adventures of Tintin, which wasn't bad. Gretchen writes The Queen's Gambit and still trying to catch up on The Crown, the series of Fargo, and Christmas Vacation. Kate writes Home Alone. Jamie writes Christmas with a Prince, Christmas Chronicles, and something else that I can't remember, probably Christmas related. Thank you. Dave writes Vice, the Dick Cheney story, and The Trial of Chicago 7. Jared writes Jingle Jangle on Netflix, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and Love Actually. Don writes Hillbilly Elegy. Stephanie writes, Can You Keep a Secret? No. David writes, The Philadelphia Story, Silverado, The Wrath of Khan, 28, that's Star Trek 2. 28 Days Later, Santa Claus 1 and 2, because yes, I'm a sucker for sappy films. Ron writes, The Glorias, not only a great film, but the best example I've seen mainstream using the master's tools to take down the master's house in terms of cinematic structure. And Christian, yeah, he's a film nerd, so what? Rachel writes Home Alone. Frank writes The Only Lovers Left Alive. It is a marvelous film. Underworld and Love and Friendship, Kate Beckinsale Fest. Mm-hmm. And the Extraordinary Adventures of Adeline Blanxette. Pardon my French. Sarah writes Jingle Jangle. It was so much fun. Doug writes Cinderella from 1950. Hello, Frisco, Hello from 1943. The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas from 1982. Say It With Songs, 1929, and most of season 4 of The Crown. Keith writes Peter Jackson's The Hobbit. Moveen writes, first time watching Failsafe with Henry Fonda. I'd vote for him for president. Cleopatra Jones and the Casino of Gold with Tamara Dobson and Stella Stevens. And the eye-popping fashion of Waves. Yeah, I own Failsafe and Cleopatra Jones and the Casino of Gold. That might be a double feature. Unless you just watch Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove, that's probably better. Jay writes, we watched a new John Belushi documentary that came out on Showtime. Really good. Abby writes, a new season of The Crown. Finally watched Point Blank. Also, my face shows up on screen for about 2 seconds. Oh, not the Lee Marvin Point Blank. And making my way through Blackadder for the first time. Congrats, Abby. Pamela writes Elona Holmes. Christian writes GoldenEye. Pretty good, but a couple things that are just too unbelievable. And sad to see the telescope that is dying in real life. Unbelievable in a James Bond film? Okay. Cassandra writes, just started watching The Queen's Gambit. Wow. Rachel writes, Juliet Naked. Kind of dumb, but I wanted a dumb movie, so to watch that was also cute. Gary writes, Frontier Wolf, The Child, I Eat Your Skin, and The Ruling Class. Amy writes, Prairie Home Companion. Amy, another Amy, also writes, That Thing You Do. And Dave writes, Thunderball, From Russia with Love, On the Rocks, had one good scene with Bill Murray and the cops, otherwise a real yawner. Started watching the Belushi documentary on Showtime and a Bobby Keys documentary on Prime. Oh, cool. And let's not forget the political storm that I can't write what he wrote. I can't say what he wrote. That's on News All Day and Night. A cross between Dr. Strangelove and the Manchurian Candidate. Queen's Gambit was very good as well. And finally, oh, look, they posted right next to each other, even though they were 3 hours apart. Kelsey writes, happiest season, Adam writes, get on up. Way to go, you crazy kids. Power of the internet, I guess. So there you go. Hope you got some ideas. Hope you get to watch some new titles, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on some old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Just keep digging. Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're staying good to one another. And hopefully next week we'll have a film sociology Thanksgiving tradition a week later. We'll see how your leftovers are doing. Tune in till then. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!